Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Among the men whose intelligence, as well as his courage, his convictions, his leadership, I've come to appreciate most in official Washington, is our first guest. He is Congressman Steve King. He represents with the greatest of distinction the people of the 4th District of Iowa, and he has been a leader on so many issues, both in his capacity as a member of the Judiciary Committee, the chairman of the House Conservative Opportunity Society, and is just a great spokesman for the patriotism and the kinds of national values that we've associated with our country for so long. Stephen King, it's great to have you, sir. Welcome back.
Well, Frank, thanks a lot for having me on. And we usually come to a mutual view on so many issues that I'm awfully glad to have this conversation with you today. I appreciate your work.
Thank you. Well, we're definitely of a mind on what I'm particularly interested in talking with you about, and that is the state of our character as a nation, really, is the way you've put it. We either have a country or we don't. And I'd like to talk with you in that connection about DACA and what President Trump is doing with respect to deferred action for childhood arrivals, as it's known better as the acronym DACA. The state of play, it's highly dynamic, it seems, at the moment. But generally speaking, what is your thought about the program, the idea of Congress giving it statutory standing, and what it might mean if we get it without some sort of enhanced security along our southern border?
Well, this, the immigration issue is, I think, the most complex issue that we deal with, more complex even than Obamacare and health care is. But with the DACA component of this, I mean, we just need to refresh our memory on a few things. And one of them is that Barack Obama said 22 times on videotape that he didn't have the constitutional authority to implement a waiver of the law as applied against those who came in here before their 18th birthday, whether or not it was their through no fault of their own. And he made it really clear many times, but he issued it anyway because he calculated, in my opinion, that he could get away with it politically, violating his constitutional oath, violating the separation of powers. And he did get away with it. And then when Donald Trump came in, he was elected in a significant part because of a strong position about restoring the respect for the rule of law and securing our border, enforcing domestic immigration law. And we expected that he would end the DACA program
right on day one, as I recall.
January 20th, noon. I thought it would be over. And instead, we're 8 months into this, and now he's hung the bait out in front of Congress and said, oh, I'm going to end it in 6 months. Right in the middle of the primary season for the midterm election. And the implication is that if Congress doesn't pass some kind of amnesty that is DACA, then he may extend it, or who knows what he might do. Plus, he'd like to have some border enforcement with it. See, I don't think there's a trade-off worth sacrificing the rule of law, Frank.
I agree with you, Congressman. Let me ask you, there's been some to-ing and fro-ing about this, so I'm a little unclear of where it actually stands, but his new friends, as he calls them, Chuck and Nancy, that would be Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, respectively, the Democratic leaders of the Senate and House. He seems to be saying that there will be a deal, that he'll quickly sign it into law, and that there will be no wall money, but perhaps other border enhancements. As a man who has seriously thought about and worked for securing our southern border, most especially, Congressman, does it make sense for us to be taking even less than half a loaf here with respect to the wall? How important is it, if you're going to engage in an amnesty program of any kind, that you stop the incomings of more people seeking amnesty?
Well, I think that, and I have studied this a lot for a long time and made multiple trips to the border, and I've spent my life in the construction business, so we could go down and build that wall and it would work. And we could put the manpower in place to maintain it, to monitor it. It's cheap in comparison to what we're doing now. But I think that the president is in a place now where he's hung the bait out there of DACA, and there's a feeding frenzy that was created by it. I think Chuck and Nancy refers to them as they were dinner guests at the White House. And it looks to me that Chuck and Nancy, they more or less betrayed the president's message out of there, or hijacked it would be maybe a more accurate term, characterized it at least through AP as a deal on DACA with no deal on the wall. And the president has been walking that back, you know, as we speak. So it's a mess that's been created unnecessarily. And Frank, I'll just add to this, that why we should have the wall, we should have border security, we should have domestic enforcement, we should have new legislation that makes the domestic enforcement better and stronger. And we've moved much of that out of the House, or at least out of the House Judiciary Committee. And to serve that up and trade it and say, we're going to give you amnesty for DACA, just so we can get the things that the American people demanded as a mandate when they elected Donald Trump. Part of the mandate was end DACA. It's like all the eggs are in one basket, and we're ready to break all kinds of eggs just to get a tiny little one out of there, which would be the end of the argument about DACA. I think that a good number of members of Congress haven't thought this through clearly. What I've learned in my time there is they arrive in Congress without having gone through a significant immigration debate, and most of what they know is what they learned during the debate, and we haven't had much.
Right. And it's not for want of your trying, that's for sure. You didn't mention E-Verify in that litany. I know that you have been attaching to the various appropriations bills, which I'm sorry to say, never seem to go anywhere anymore, at least in the United States Senate. But talk about the importance of the E-Verify provisions that you've sought and that ought to be applied, obviously.
Well, yes. And I want to say Ken Calvert of California brought the E-Verify program probably 20 years ago as the basic pilot program. They started it as a pilot program and they began to develop it out. And now E-Verify has come to the point where if you're an employer and with a legitimate proposal, an offer, you can take that prospective employee's information, I call it name, rank, and serial number, pop that into E-Verify, and in seconds you get an answer back if it can confirm that an individual can legally work in the United States. And it's accurate up into the 99th point something percentile. And the error factor there is usually when someone has gotten married and didn't change their maiden name to their married name. So it's an excellent program, works good. To make it mandatory for all employers in America would help a lot to start cleaning up the illegal employment that's taking place out there.
And shutting off the magnet for more amnesty-seeking individuals coming into this country illegally, needless to say.
Well, it does that, or at least it shuts it down significantly, if not completely off. It leaves the opening there for somebody that's providing false information, document fraud, and of a social security number and a birth certificate and those things that would be utilized for identification. Or they could just present their information falsely, the information of someone who can legally work in America. So E-Verify is not perfect, but it's the best we have, and it needs to be made mandatory. And I have another bill that takes E-Verify another level with that, and it clarifies that it's called the New Illegal Deduction Elimination Act. And so it clarifies that deducting wages paid to it is not a legitimate tax deduction, not a business expense. IRS would come in under my bill, run an audit, and punch the information of the employees that are listed on the Schedule C as a business expense, the wages to them, pop that into E-Verify. If it comes back that they cannot lawfully work in America, they would deny that as a business deduction. So say if you're an employer and you paid $1 million in wages out to illegals, IRS would do an audit on you. You're going to be vulnerable 6 years back. The IRS would run those numbers through the E-Verify database. And if they can determine that they're illegals, unlawfully working in America, they would say, sorry, you can't deduct this $1 million a year as a business expense. Now it's a taxable income. And we're going to charge you interest and penalty on that, plus the tax liability. And that takes your $10 an hour illegal up to about $16 an hour. And then that vulnerability multiplied times 6 years, and it's a deterrent effect all employers.
It sounds like a powerful disincentive, and heavens knows that's what's needed. Congressman, I wanted to ask you about College Park and giving folks who are not citizens, in fact, including illegal aliens, the vote and the implications of that. But we'll have to leave it at that for the moment. I know you've got to go. We appreciate your time so much, sir, and your great service to our country and the United States Congress. Congressman Steve King of Iowa, I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're very pleased to have with us a man who has spent much of his life, certainly an extraordinarily important professional career, trying to protect our borders and our interior, for that matter, as a senior special agent in the Immigration and Naturalization Services. He is Michael Cutler. He hosts his own radio program Friday evenings on Blog Talk Radio. You can also find his writings at places like Front Page Magazine, Family Security Matters, and the like. He is a man of great expertise on the sorts of issues we were just discussing with Congressman Steve King, and we're delighted to have him back for, a second opinion, perhaps. Michael, good to have you with us, sir.
Good to join you. Steve King's a great guy. I'm glad you're able to speak with him today.
Me too. Let me ask you to sort of quickly, if you would, reminisce with us a little bit from your firsthand experiences with 9/11 and the lessons that we have failed to learn with respect to immigration.
Well, you know, the 9/11 Commission was created the way that the NASA had a commission that was supposed to figure out why the Challenger blew up and so forth. The idea is to make certain that we don't suffer from history yet again. And one of the key issues, or a couple of the key issues, was equating border security with national security, number one. Number two, looking at the visa process and saying, you know, those terrorists were able to get visas way too easily. Incredibly, on 9/11, we had 26 visa waiver countries. You would think after that admonition, maybe we would get rid of the visa waiver program altogether. I certainly would argue for doing that. Instead, they expanded the visa waiver program, so now we're up to 38 countries. We know that the terrorists in the aggregate used 364 false aliases or variations of false aliases, and yet you have municipalities providing municipal ID to illegal aliens who can't properly identify themselves.
Part of that sort of larger sanctuary cities binge as well.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Because what this does is to encourage, entice, induce, harbor, shield. These are all elements of felonies under federal immigration statutes, aliens who are illegally present in the United States. And somehow we have this mistaken notion that it's charitable and compassionate to ignore our borders and ignore the immigration laws that are founded on two basic principles: protect American lives and protect the jobs of American workers. This isn't about hating anybody, and we don't make distinction by race, religion, or ethnicity.
Yeah. Michael Cutler, you know, it raises an interesting question. Could we simply prosecute for felony offenses in the pursuit of these kinds of activities, some of those in sanctuary cities who are, in the name of charity or whatever, violating the law?
Well, I know states' rights kind of gets in the middle of it, but I would argue that we probably could, especially if you have people in leadership positions in prisons and so forth who are supposed to administer the laws, who ignore detainers that are lodged by immigration agents. There are actions that could be, and I think should be, taken. Incredibly, the courts have become an adversary, even if you look at what's happened with the so-called travel ban. You know, I want your audience to understand that this order, the travel ban, isn't the travel ban. The actual title provides real clarity, and the public, I suspect, would favor it. So they've come up with this wacky term, travel ban. The actual title is protecting the nation from the entry of foreign terrorists into the United States.
Yeah, and to that end, and temporary immigration pause is what was in order. Michael Cutler, let me switch gears. More generally, there is an awful lot going on at the moment in terms of the public, I guess you'd call it, discourse or debate about immigration policy, notably as a result of President Trump's recent action deciding to kick back to the Congress the so-called DACA arrangements, deferred action on childhood arrivals. This is playing out as we speak with Twitters even earlier today from the president after Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, or as he calls them, Chuck and Nancy, came away from a conversation in the White House with him last night saying we were all good to go now on getting this DACA measure through the House without having any further progress on building a wall, as it's been called, a barrier on the southern border. Would you walk us through what you think is going on here and the implications, Michael?
Well, it's hard to figure out what's going on. You know, I find it remarkable. Chuck Schumer has advocated for creating a 5-year felony, a penalty, 5 years in jail for trespass on critical infrastructure, national landmarks. Yet it's Chuck Schumer who wants to give citizenship to people who trespass on America. I find that very remarkable. But the problem with DACA is that we're talking about 800,000 people who might be as old as 36 years of age. We keep hearing about kids, but remember, the age cutoff was 31 back in 2012 when it was created. By now, they'd be up to 36. There have been no face-to-face interviews of any of these people, no field investigations. The likelihood of immigration fraud is high. Immigration fraud, again, going back to the 9/11 Commission, was the key entry and embedding tactic of the terrorists. Furthermore, what's never discussed is all of these aliens, if they got lawful status and ultimately U.S. citizenship, could file petitions to bring in all of their siblings and their siblings' families. So in other words, if they have six brothers and sisters, and those brothers and sisters have an average of a half dozen children, one alien getting lawful status and citizenship could ultimately bring in 60 or 70 more immigrants.
Again, without confidence that we would know, let alone be able to screen who those people are.
But beyond that, think of all the money we're spending on English as a second language in American schools across the country while kids with ADHD, autism, and other learning disabilities are finding fewer resources available, but the schools have to make the tough choice. Do we spend money on American kids, which I think they should? My youngest son has a form of autism. Or do we put money into English as a second language? We have limited money, limited resources. Why in the world doesn't there anyone stand up and talk about what American children would be best suited with?
Right. And you know, Michael, you've been active with Californians for Population Stabilization. I know that that group has been very concerned about the proliferation of public services that have to be provided, not just in the schools, but across government, in all of the languages of people who are now here, not English. So these are real practical considerations. But just to come back to something you talked about in terms of the context of the 9/11 lessons, these issues of who is in the country, who is getting here illegally, who is getting here, for that matter, legally, but without proper vetting, are national security issues at the end of the day. And just as a professional, having spent so much of your life in the Immigration and Naturalization Services system, Michael, just give us an appreciation of how significant a national security problem you'd say we have now with, by some estimates, 12 million or more illegal aliens in this country, for starters.
Well, let's just look at the numbers. It was 19 young terrorists barely out of their teens on 9/11 who inflicted more casualties on the United States than did the entire Japanese fleet at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. You know, there used to be a mantra that we don't hear much of anymore. The terrorists got to get it right only once. We've got to be right 100% of the time. Every alien who enters the United States provides terrorists with the opportunity of getting it right that one time. We've naturalized terrorists before they've carried out their attacks. Think about the Tsarnaev family. They got political asylum, promptly went back to Russia. You would think that that should have caused them to lose their status. Political asylum means I have a credible fear I can never go home. One of their brothers became a naturalized citizen before they carried out that deadly attack.
Michael, we are out of time. We could go on this, I know. I would just say one of the things that's really interesting to me is that even Angela Merkel, who has arguably done more to destroy her country than anybody else by virtue of bringing in unknown persons by the millions, has begun saying, listen, if you go back to your country of origin for vacation, we're going to have to rethink whether you actually are entitled to asylum in our country. There's so much more to talk about. Michael Cutler, I appreciate your time today. I commend to our listeners hearing you on the Michael Cutler Hour on Friday evenings on Blog Talk Radio. Also, check out his writings at Front Page Magazine, Family Security Matters, and elsewhere. Michael, thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Deborah Weiss will join us. We'll talk with her about the experiences of another individual who was right there by ground zero on 9/11 and the threat we're facing today to free speech. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a friend and colleague now of, well, many years, by the name of Deborah Weiss. She has had some very firsthand and hard personal experience with the threats that I describe as part and parcel of the war for the free world. Notably, some personal experience with 9/11 that I want her to talk a little bit about, as well as her work subsequent to that to try to help the rest of us understand the challenges that we're facing now from Sharia supremacism. She is the author of The Organization of Islamic Cooperation's Jihad on Free Speech. We'll talk about that, as well as a forthcoming book, both of these from the Center for Security Policy Press, about the Islamists and their influence in Hollywood. Deborah Weiss, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
I did want to say, in the immediate aftermath of the anniversaries of now three attacks on this country and its interests on 9/11, but notably that of 2001, you were there, literally, at Ground Zero. Talk very quickly, if you would, about both that experience, what you took away from it, and how it's informed so much of what you've done since.
Well, there were three zones after the attack. And I was on the inner zone, which is called Ground Zero. So you had to have a pass to get into each zone, and you had to have more passes the closer in you were. Both my home and my office were affected. I was running for my life. I wound up staying with strangers in New Jersey. I was homeless for 2 months. My office was closed in this place for 8 months. We had a whole wall blown off. And I didn't know anything about the subject at the time. As you know, my background is as a lawyer, and that's what I was working as at the time. But I wound up, once I was able to get my bearings together, I set out to explore why these terrorists wanted to kill me and everyone I knew. And my original interest was Islamic terrorism. And then somehow a few years later, somebody mentioned in passing something about the OIC wants to criminalize our discussions on terrorism. And at the time, I thought they sounded crazy. But instead of concluding that was the case, I came back and started looking up the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and found out that that indeed was what they were trying to do. And I wound up on my own time, on my own dime, spending day and night with my head in the UN resolutions that they were passing, and then following what they were doing to understand how they were interpreting their own language. And somehow I just instinctively knew that freedom of speech was the battlefield upon which we were going to win or lose what we call the war of ideas. So obviously we have to have the kinetic component and the military component, but I just knew that the language was critical, and I wound up shifting focuses.
Debbie, let me ask you, you mentioned these resolutions. One of them, of course, was the Human Rights Council Resolution 1618. And that was really a major breakthrough for the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and others on the left. Talk a little bit about what's been going on in Europe, in particular, in Canada, closer to home, and here, in the aftermath of the adoption by the United Nations Human Rights Council of that resolution.
I have to say something about the resolutions prior to that, which were all called defamation of religions. And by that, the OIC meant defamation of Islam. In fact, that was the original title of the resolution, but it didn't get support when they called it what it was. So they called it defamation of religions. However, the only religion singled out in the text was Islam. We were passing that on a worldwide scale in the UN for about 11 years, until the West started to realize that they're not defining the word the same way we are. We have defamation laws here, but you can only defame a person only if it's a false statement, and only opinions are protected speech, and truth is a defense. None of that is the case when the OIC uses the word defamation. Originally, the State Department asked them to write a resolution that would protect free speech and still address their concerns about so-called Islamophobia, and that's what Resolution 1618 was, which was to condemn hostility and violence based on religion and belief, and it didn't use the phrase defamation of religion. So the State Department and many conservative Christian organizations were really happy because they thought, oh, great, now we'll have free expression. The problem was they still had that same goal to protect Islam from defamation, and they were able to manipulate the language to make it mean that. So there were several problematic clauses, but the main problematic clause was the incitement to violence. They wanted it criminalized. And we signed on to it because it's illegal to incite imminent violence here, but we go by what you actually say. Like if I say, go kill Joe tomorrow at 2, and a whole bunch of people listen to me and do it, I'll be responsible for inciting violence. But that's not how the OIC defines it. If you draw a picture of the Muhammad, of the Muslim prophet Muhammad, you know, or you just say something they disagree with on Islam or that's critical on Islam, even if it's true, then when they riot, like in the Danish cartoon incident, then you incited the violence, but just by making your comment. So it's called a test of consequences. And it's so the whole thing is about two things. Number one is criminalizing Islamic blasphemy. One is for religious purposes, to make non-Muslims comply with blasphemy laws. But the second reason, and the one that we're interested in, is to make sure that they have a safe space to advance jihadi goals without anybody scrutinizing them.
Debbie, this is really important because we've got to take all of that information and translate it into what's just been happening in the United States Congress. Both the House and the Senate this week adopted joint resolutions, which are supposedly going to the president, which I assume will result in his approving them, that essentially cast as hate speech the kinds of comments, the kinds of activities that took place in Charlottesville. How does that play into, maybe not immediately, but at least incrementally, into this idea, in which, by the way, the Islamists are joined at the hip with the hard left to restrict our freedom of speech in this country? We've seen it in Europe. We've seen it in Canada. You were just up at a conference talking about this. Are we seeing it here now? And if so, how serious a threat does it represent to our constitutional freedoms?
We are seeing it here now, and I do think it's a problem. People take the First Amendment for granted. But as you see, if things were so clear, we wouldn't have split court decisions, and we have them all the time. So all we need is five justices to wrongly interpret the First Amendment to exclude hate speech from protection, and we will have hate speech laws. The resolution you're referring to, Frank, House Joint Resolution 117, I do think is a little bit different but related, because what that resolution does is it didn't mention anything about speech, actually, but it said condemning the violence and terrorist attacks and condemning the hate groups and the KKK and the neo-Nazis and urging the president and his cabinet to use all available resources to address those threats. And I think the problem with that is, first of all, it's completely missing the point. The threat from those groups is minuscule compared to the jihadi threat. If you look around the globe and look at what's happening in Europe, in the West, in Orlando, in San Bernardino, it's the jihadi terrorist threat, and now what they call lone wolf, which is also a falsehood, but ISIS-inspired attacks using knives, using automobiles, using everyday weapons that you can get when you don't have a bomb. That is the true threat.
So we're being deflected from that, and we're being told that don't look at that Sharia supremacism over there. That is not to be worried about. There's this vast white supremacist problem over here. Debbie, we are hard out of time, I'm afraid, but I just wanted to say thank you for the work that you have done. Check it out at, among other places, the Weekly Standard, folks. It is extraordinarily important. Also, her books published at the Center for Security Policy Press on the OIC, and her forthcoming one about Hollywood. Those are available for free at securefreedom.org. Debbie Weiss, thank you so much for joining us. We'll come back to you very soon. Fred Flights is up next. We'll talk with him about the latest developments on the Iran-Obama bomb deal. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by my colleague Fred Flights, our senior vice president at the Center for Security Policy for Policy and Programs. He is a career intelligence professional with 20 years of experience in the Central Intelligence Agency, service as the chief of staff to then Undersecretary of State John Bolton, and a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee. He is the author of Obama Bomb, the Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. He has been very productive and incredibly effective in warning about that deal, particularly of late on the pages of publications like the National Review and Newsmax, FoxNews.com, Fox News, and elsewhere. It's so good to have him with us. Fred Flights, thanks for all your hard work in this effort.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
I want to talk to you most immediately about where we are on the Iran deal. There's a report today that, at least as we speak, the president is being importuned by those in his administration who like this Obama bomb deal, that he must now once again waive the sanctions that would otherwise go into effect against Iran in the run-up to, I guess, another decision by him as to whether Iran is in compliance. Give us the latest on what's happening, Fred.
Well, this week, the president has to decide whether to continue to waive certain sanctions, I think related to energy. But the biggest decision comes next month. Every 90 days, the president has to certify to Congress that the agreement is in the interest of the United States and that Iran is complying. And the president made this certification in April and July, very, very reluctantly. And frankly, he was pretty angry in July that he wasn't given any options to leave the deal. All the options were to stay with the deal, and his advisors, especially National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, pressed him very hard because I'm afraid there's several senior Trump advisors who are just too close to the foreign policy establishment. They don't want to get out of this deal because they don't want to offend the Europeans. Well, now we have a decision on or about October 15th. I'm hoping the president will get out and he will follow a fabulous plan put together by Ambassador John Bolton in response to the president's request for another option. Mr. Bolton published this in National Review. I understand the president has seen it. I hope that's the way he goes.
Well, I do too, but it will be over the dead bodies of H.R. McMaster and Jim Mattis and Rex Tillerson, it would appear. Fred, there are, of course, those in addition to his cabinet officers who are pushing alternatives to the Bolton alternative. You have described them as signs of desperation on the part of the Iran deal's backers in a recent piece at National Review. What are the arguments that are being made for yet another approach, and why are they defective as you see it?
Well, I was very pleased that National Review published my article on September 13th. The Iran deal's backers are getting desperate. And what's going on here is I think the people who back this deal, they're very worried that the president is on the verge of not just decertifying this deal to Congress, but withdrawing from it. And they've thrown up a series of arguments to sort of muddy the waters and to, in some ways, give him a chance to take some dramatic action that looks very significant, but still keeps us in the deal. And some of these arguments are the Iran is in compliance with the deal. And I'm saying that that's a false argument because Iran will not allow inspections of military sites. And there's also a quote I have from a control organization that explained that's not the case, that any violations are minor and immaterial. I sent a letter from four U.S. senators who explained that's not the case and that there is reporting from German intelligence that Iran has covertly cheated on the deal. that the president should decertify the agreement, but stay in it and spend several years trying to fix it. This is really a fantasy because the Iranians have said, we're never going to agree to amendments. They know the sweetheart deal they got with this agreement. And frankly, this is a proposal to keep us in the agreement forever. Another one is, well, we're getting more inspections under this agreement, which is true, but the Iranians won't allow inspections to military sites, and that's where the weapons activity is going on. And finally, let's just put this on a back burner and adopt a broader plan to address the threats from Iran. We'll deal with the deal later. Really, it's another false argument. It's a smokescreen. We do need a broader plan to deal with Iran, but the nuclear issue is the most significant factor. And, you know, frankly, we can't have a sensible overall strategy to confront Iran that excludes the nuclear deal. So, again, it's another false argument.
Yeah, and Fred, you have spent much of your career following not just Iranian activities in the weapons of mass destruction space, but also those of North Korea, its strategic partner. And one thing that jumps out at me about this is that if you look at what has happened as a result of successive administrations' efforts to kick the can down the road or characterize as a larger issue and to work on it in a most feckless manner. With the bomb, the options for changing policy and having a real impact on behavior of these, you know, rogue regimes is greatly diminished. So, you know, waiting a few more years as Iran inexorably moves closer and closer to having this nuclear capability, if it doesn't already, is a formula for essentially leaving us with the same bad options we've now got with North Korea, isn't it?
I mean, that's exactly right. It is a recipe for global nuclear proliferation. We know Iran has been funding North Korea's nuclear program. And CIA Director Pompeo, he wouldn't confirm collaboration on the North Korean nuclear programs in a recent Fox interview, but he indicated that it can't be ruled out. I got to tell you, I think it's going on. I think the Iranians are actively funding and sharing in the technological leaps that the North Koreans are making in the nuclear weapons program.
There are some Fred flights, as you know, who say that they actually are conducting in North Korea nuclear experimentation and tests, even perhaps also ballistic missile tests for the Iranians. So it's hard to believe that this isn't advancing dramatically the Iranian threat as we know it, perhaps notwithstanding such inspection provisions as are in place under the JCPOA. Hey, Fred, lastly, quickly, I wanted to ask you, Susan Rice has now provided some explanation for why she was unmasking people who were American citizens caught up in the surveillance of foreign nationals, including some active in the Trump campaign. Can you shed any light on that, having raised concerns about what she's been doing in the past?
Well, apparently she was concerned that a Middle East power was having meetings in New York with the Trump transition, and this Middle East power didn't tell the White House about the meetings. This is a ridiculous explanation. Rice was trying to obtain DMAS names of Trump officials for almost a year. This isn't the explanation. I mean, you know the old saying, if you're in a hole, stop digging. Well, she's digging herself into a deeper hole by making this ridiculous claim.
I know you'll be following this closely, Fred Flights, as do we. Your very incredibly important writing at National Review and Newsmax, foxnews.com and elsewhere. I know you'll keep it up, and I know that you'll come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.